Hello. One of the themes that I've been coming back to in the last few lectures has been this question of how archaeologists recognize the origins of ancient states, how they can define their appearance, and particularly how they can understand the origins of ancient states and civilizations in different social political forms, in societies that are less hierarchical, less centralized than ancient states. Often the issue of recognizing those states themselves is actually less complicated than the question of how we recognize their predecessors. We have to deal with the complexities of actual archaeological cases. Not only archaeological cases, we've certainly seen, for example, with ancient examples like that of Shetal-Hayuk. Now, Shetal-Hayuk certainly was not a state or anywhere near it. It was, however, a large, complex, ancient community that seems to have run according to social and political rules that are perhaps unfamiliar to us from most circumstances today. So we have to try and understand that very different case. Even with much more recent cases where we have far more ethnographic and historical information, as for example with the Wandala, this can still pose questions. I talked last time about this socio-political sequence, and I'll be talking about it in future as well. A sequence between bands to tribes to chiefdoms to states. Do these categories actually make sense when we talk, for example, about the Wandala? Do we think of Wandala as a state? Probably yes, but obviously it's a very particular kind of state. It wouldn't make any more sense to call it a chiefdom. It would fit just as badly there. So what we have to always be aware of is the potential diversity that these different social political forms can encompass. We have to ask ourselves, is this in and of itself a useful way to think about political and cultural developments in different parts of the world that lead to states? How universal is this band to tribe to chiefdom to state trajectory across the world and through time? Are alternative trajectories possible? This is an issue we'll come back to. As I noted in my last lecture, there are in particular some uncertainties associated with the concept of chiefdom, and especially with the degree of political and social variability among societies designated in that way, designated as chiefdoms. In a sense, this is inevitable. If we're thinking of chiefdoms as, among other things, intermediate forms between relatively egalitarian societies, tribes perhaps, and relatively non-egalitarian societies, states, the intermediate forms are probably going to be fairly variable. If chiefdoms vary so much, does it mean that the definition of chiefdoms actually incorporates fundamentally different kinds of political systems, which should not be lumped together? I used in my last lecture two extremes, if you like, societies that have been defined as chiefdoms. Sukkur in northern Nigeria as one of the very simplest forms of chiefdoms. Hawaii, pre-European Hawaii, as a very complex stratified chiefdom. Is it a good idea to even place these two societies, Sukkur and Hawaii, within one single category? However, this may also reflect wider problems with the idea of a single evolutionary trajectory from bands to states. And so I want to think a little bit more about this culture of archaeological understandings about how societies develop politically through time in this lecture. Now, I've noted already that evolutionary schemes have been very important in archaeology. For more than a century, in part because they allow researchers to think analytically about cultural change through time. That's very significant. And they also allow us to classify a whole variety of different ancient communities into a limited number of analytical categories, which can then be studied systematically and comparatively. If we want to think of archaeology as a science concerned with comparison and classification as necessary precursors to explanation, then this is obviously important. It will come as no surprise that these evolutionary schemes were influenced to some degree by the success of theories of biological evolution in the mid-19th century. Although to some degree evolutionary concepts were being recognized as important even before Darwin. We have to recognize that there are differences, though, between biological and cultural concepts of evolution. Just to note, this is a far greater topic than can be addressed in these lectures. But there are really significant issues here. In cultural evolution, what is the unit that selection pressure occurs on? Is it the individual human? Is it communities of humans? Is it a single culture? Where is selection occurring? What are the cultural equivalents to biological species? What is the unit and the mode of transmission of information in cultural evolution? The cultural equivalent to a gene, for example. What is that? Whole range of questions of this sort. If we think of cultural evolution just using simple biological analogs, without considering the real differences between biology and culture, we're certainly, absolutely going to be led astray. Archaeologists and other researchers work with these issues successfully, but the relationship between biological evolution and cultural evolution is often not obvious. And it's certainly not necessarily the case that these evolutionary schema are applicable to all cases of cultural change that we see in the archaeological record. Let's look at some of the background then of these evolutionary schemes, the way that they developed themselves, that they evolved, if you like, themselves from the mid-19th century onward. The earliest influential evolutionary models in anthropology were unilinear. That is, they posited a single evolutionary trajectory for all human societies, everywhere and always. These were popular and significant and influential in the middle and late 19th century. The evolutionary theory developed by Edward Tylor and refined by Lewis Henry Morgan, for example, had three successive stages, with each of these in turn divided into three different substages, and with different technological, economic, social, political, and religious characteristics assigned to each stage. Let's consider these stages in turn. The first and original stage of human cultural evolution, according to Tylor and Morgan, was savagery. Savagery was characteristic of hunter-gatherer communities without knowledge of farming. At the lowest substage of savagery, known as lower savagery, we're really talking about the initial separation of humans from apes, and then progressive development toward the kinds of foraging hunter-gatherer populations that we see in different parts of the world today. The San people that I've already talked about, often known as the Bushmen of southern Africa, or Australian Aboriginal populations. Characteristic of these communities in this first evolutionary stage of savagery was supposed to be very simple technology, supposedly the simplest forms of undifferentiated family life and kinship, not particularly well organized. Worship of the elements, simple, uninflected languages. So the sense here was that at the stage of savagery, societies were in all ways, if you like, simple, basic. The second stage, then, in this three-stage system, classification system, was barbarism. Barbarism is associated with the invention of the first simple farming systems, horticulture systems, and eventually with the taming of domestic animals like cattle and horses. Lower barbarism, again, three substages, lower, middle, and upper barbarism. Lower barbarism would be tribal confederacies akin to those of the pre-European Iroquois in northeastern North America. While on the other hand, upper barbarism would include the small Mycenaean states that we'll look at later in this set of lectures, or societies, for example, of the Central European Bronze Age. Again, the progression from lower to middle to upper barbarism involves particular technological advances associated with each stage, including the successive development of weaving, irrigation systems, urbanism, and ironworking, along with a whole variety of other kinds of technical innovations. At the end of the stage of upper barbarism, mythologies and monogamy had been invented, and I'm not sure if there's supposed to be any necessary relationship there or not. Again, each of these substages within barbarism was associated with different kinds of religion, different kinds of family system, different kinds of languages, and so on. The third, then, of these stages in Tyler and Morgan's unilinear evolutionary sequence, the third of the stages was civilization. For Tyler and Morgan, civilization was really associated with history, with the origins of writing, and the development of large-scale states and empires. Civilization began then with Egyptians and Mesopotamians 5,000 years ago, and we'll be spending time looking at this development in this set of lectures. It progresses through ancient, medieval, and modern forms. So again, three substages, but in this case, not lower, middle, and upper, but rather ancient, medieval, and modern civilization. Unsurprisingly, given the association with writing, the advances, the developments are much more specific here. Thus, for example, the appearance of a pope as a representative of medieval civilization, for some reason medieval civilization. For modern civilization, a wonderful laundry list of technical advances. The power loom, the canal lock, gunpowder, modern science, religious freedom, representative democracy, and classes. So on the one hand, you've got the canal lock, and the other hand, representative democracy, characteristic of modern civilization. For Tyler and Morgan, modern civilization really was the culmination, the apotheosis, of many tens of thousands of years, now we would say millions of years, of human evolution. It's no surprise in a model of this sort that European societies of the Victorian era occupied the very highest rank on this evolutionary ladder. Note that I've mentioned both ancient and recent societies when I've been talking about Tyler and Morgan's unilinear evolutionary scheme. Not only ancient societies like the ancient Mesopotamians, but modern societies, or relatively modern societies, like Iroquois communities in the northeastern United States. One characteristic of this unilinear evolutionary scheme is that contemporary late 19th century societies, at the time the system was developed, contemporary late 19th century societies across the world could be placed on the same evolutionary ladder as were ancient communities, according to their cultural characteristics as determined by ethnography and archaeology. Thus, it didn't really matter if a society existed 100 years ago or 10,000 years ago. as long as they had the same technical and cultural and social and ideological characteristics, according to this scheme, they occupied the same evolutionary rung on this ladder. So there's an equivalence of space and time in these evolutionary ideas. We can examine evolutionary change according to Tyler and Morgan's model by looking backwards in time, certainly, which is the way we tend to think about evolution, but also by looking across the globe spatially, away, of course, from the apex of civilization in Europe and the cities of North America. This equivalence between prehistoric and contemporary communities frequently meant that certain societies, particularly those people who were still hunter-gatherers in the late 19th century, were seen as living relics of ancient times, almost marooned, if you like, in the present from prehistory. As I said, one could then go out from the centers of civilization, of modern civilization, which I suppose for Tyler and Morgan would be places like Cambridge or Harvard. One could then go out from those centers, and by going away from these centers, by going in space to Africa, to South America, to the Arctic, to the central desert of Australia, to Southeast Asia, one was actually going back in evolutionary time to look at ancient societies marooned in the present. This was very convenient in a colonial era, for a colonial world, because it allowed colonial rulers to claim that they had taken over colonies in these other areas in order to assist backward populations in their long climb towards civilization. To some degree, I must say, we still do this. Africa, for example, is still far too often seen as, in some sense, the land that time forgot. Those San or Bushmen, to use that obsolete term, hunter-gatherers in southern Africa, are still seen as untouched remnants of ancient times, innocent, noble savages at best, almost animals at worst. This is still not an uncommon portrayal of these populations, both within the sciences and in popular culture. One very popular movie of 1980, a South African film called The Gods Must Be Crazy, which got widespread attention across the world, explicitly portrayed San people in southern Africa as untouched by history. By the early 20th century, it was becoming obvious that these unilinear models did not accurately reflect the cultural diversity of societies across the globe. They didn't work. In many cases, the set of features claimed to be characteristic of each successive stage of cultural evolution, of savagery and barbarism and civilization, did not coexist in the vast majority of the societies that were classified as having evolved to that stage. Thus, for example, groups of people supposed to be savages, like Australian Aboriginal populations or Inuit, Eskimo people, were supposed to have really simple, basic, unsophisticated technologies, and correspondingly basic, unsophisticated kinship and family systems, religious beliefs and languages. By the end of the 19th century, as Westerners began to have more long-term knowledge of these people, it was becoming obvious that this wasn't the case at all. Thus, in the Arctic, European explorers died in significant numbers through the 19th century, even though they were supported by the whole panoply of Victorian technological progress, all that progress of modern civilization. While those people who adopted the technologies used by Inuit populations in the region actually did much better. Those explorers who learned from the Inuit survived and actually did useful work. Europeans came to realize that these simple indigenous technologies were often extremely well adapted through millennia to life in sometimes extreme environments. And of course, perceptive observers realized that an excellent adaptation to local environments is actually what evolution is all about. Similarly, Ethnographic work demonstrated that these same, quote, savages, unquote, often had extraordinarily complex languages and kinship systems and religious systems, sometimes far more complicated than those of their European observers. A well-known anthropologist of the 20th century, Claude Lévi-Strauss, was moved to call Australian Aboriginal populations intellectual dandies on just that basis. In addition, these models significantly understated the complexity and diversity of the historical changes that have taken place among populations in different areas of the world. Do populations go through these different stages and substages sequentially? Well, no, in many cases they do not. We're going to see throughout this course that there are, in fact, great differences in the speed, the tempo, the particular pathways through which, for example, states develop in different regions. Importantly as well, these unilinear evolutionary models offered no convincing mechanism that would account for differences in cultural development in different regions. Why is it that, according to these models, some areas evolve faster than others? Why would this particular sequence exist, and how do we explain the positioning of particular societies along this succession from savagery to barbarism to civilization? What would lead to cultural advance in some areas and to lack of advance in others? Race? Intelligence? Climate? Geography? Most of the obvious explanations of the period were fairly conclusively disproved. We come back, though, to this major question, always to this question. Should we be searching for a single prime mover or a small number of prime movers, of factors that are going to explain processes of cultural change everywhere and always? Or do we need to look for more local and historical alternatives? Of course, these are not really dichotomized. These are not really two completely different responses. We may well find, indeed we will find, that there are some factors that crop up very frequently in developments towards states and civilizations in different parts of the world. Perhaps not in all cases, but in a number of cases. I'm not going to give away any surprises when I say that agricultural intensification, urbanism, trade and exchange, especially between elites on the make, religious ceremonialism will come up again and again as important elements in state formation through this series of lectures. But these are always modified by regional and local circumstances. And I would say that they are modified to such a degree that the idea of finding one single unilinear evolutionary trajectory towards states and civilizations that will hold everywhere is an utter mirage. There's a joke in archaeology. I think it's probably fairly common in the social sciences more generally, but I know it in archaeology. That we can come up with lovely, tight explanations, tight theories that are fit well together, that explain a lot, as long as we don't actually have too many data. When we actually start to do a lot of field work in an area and accumulate a mass of really good data on a particular archaeological problem, things get messy. And those tight, well-integrated theories fairly often fall apart. Reality tends to be a little more messy than the theories that we generate. And the collision between reality and theories of unilinear evolution was prototypical of this. So, Tyler and Morgan's unilinear evolutionary theories were gradually abandoned through the early 20th century. It became obvious that they simply were not accounting for the variability and the diversity of human cultural development in different parts of the world at different times. Of course, at the same time, the search for better definitions, more precise definitions of human advance and human civilization continued. If we think of ourselves, as I've said, as I will continue to say, if we think of ourselves as scientists interested in comparison, we have to think about these questions. Archaeologists and anthropologists busied themselves coming up with lists of traits that they thought would characterize cultural phenomena like civilization. What would be the set of characteristics that we would associate with civilizations in different parts of the world? Now, the problem is it became very difficult to come up with a single list of characteristics that would define civilizations everywhere. When I use the term civilization in this course, as I've said, I'm using it in a slightly different way. I'm talking about regional cultural distributions that different societies partake of. Between the 1920s and the 1950s, the Australian archaeologist V. Gordon Child developed significantly more sophisticated models for the origins of states and civilizations, in part because of inspiration from Karl Marx's writings on the connections between economic relations, social systems, and ideologies. If we want to think about how these developments work, then, according to Child, we should think about a variety of different interlocking processes happening through time. These developments then towards states and civilizations would be located first in increases in agricultural productivity through time, which led to the existence of food surpluses. That is, a circumstance in which farmers are growing enough food in order to be able to support members of the population who are not farmers themselves, who do other things, who are perhaps priests or kings or members of the nobility or soldiers or merchants. These increases in agricultural productivity he located particularly, for example, in irrigation agriculture in the Near East. This led in turn to population growth. These factors working together, increases in agricultural productivity and population growth, made possible the appearance of occupational specialists who could devote themselves full time to craft production, religious pursuits, or trade. The centralization necessary to successfully coordinate these more complex economic and social systems then led to the appearance of urban centers controlled by elites through the accumulation of tributes and taxation. All of this made possible, as I've said, by increased agricultural and other kinds of economic output. And these processes ultimately led to the appearance of states and their rulers and many other of the accoutrements of states that we're familiar with. Monumental architecture, writing systems, written laws, military forces, and so on. Again, archaeologists have criticized Child's models on the grounds that they may not account for the details of state formation everywhere in the world. Thus, just to give one example, there's an assumption that agricultural advance will be at the root of all later developments. This may well be the case in the Near East, but is it correct everywhere in the world? How about the development of urban centers and elites? Are they necessary? Will we always find them in every ancient state, every ancient civilization? We're going to be examining these issues as we go through the course. What we'll see is that Child's ideas do not, in fact, explain the growth of states and civilizations everywhere, but they're extremely productive ways to think about these issues in many circumstances. It's interesting to realize that the band, tribe, chiefdom, state succession that I've been talking about could also be seen as an evolutionary model, a unilinear evolutionary model, if one was so inclined. We'd have to note that it's a much more general evolutionary sequence than those of, for example, Tyler and Morgan. There's a good deal of argument about the generality of this succession, band, tribe, chiefdom, state, as we'll see in the next lecture. And personally, I don't think it's useful to think of this succession as a set-in-stone evolutionary sequence, but rather a heuristic that's useful in discussing general trends in state formation. Many archaeologists would agree with that, I think. So for my next lecture, I'll consider especially these debates in archaeology about how and when we can detect the initial appearance of states in the archaeological record and what their characteristics may be. Thank you.